When the federal government began buying land in the San Francisco Bay Area for conservation, the process affected ranchers, fishermen, and a small oyster farm in Point Reyes. The farm became the subject of a prolonged battle that went far beyond Point Reyes, touching on the meaning of wilderness, the role of the federal government in managing land, and the big impact that a small business can make to a fragile ecosystem. Summer Brennan has chronicled the battle in her book, The Oyster War. It's published by Counterpoint. I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Who started the first oyster farm in this place called Drake's Estero? I guess Estero is Spanish for estuary?
It's actually not Spanish for estuary. When I was looking into it, I expected that that was the case, but actually Estuario is Spanish, and Estero is Esperanto for estuary.
Which Esperanto?
Yes, which I thought was really interesting. Maybe it was a dialect, a dialect at the time. The first person to farm oysters in Drake's Estero was a man named Pat Quayle, who started in the 30s, and he was a bit of an eccentric character. He was a biologist and an artist, and when he would sign his name, he would draw a little quail, you know, at the end. So he started out first thing as part of a project in California to expand oyster farming.
But this was not a promising place to do oyster farming.
No,
why did he choose it?
They had been prospecting all over the area. San Francisco Bay in the 19th century had been a fertile place to farm imported oysters from Washington State and also from New York and New Jersey. There was a very booming industry for many decades. But due to pollution, mostly from coal with the ferry boats and also sewage, the oyster beds in San Francisco Bay had died out by the turn of the century, mostly.
You know, New York had great oyster beds, too.
Oh,
and
yes.
They're all gone.
Yes, I know. They are working to restore them, though. Some really great projects going on. But anyway, after that happened, there was still a market for oysters, but not the habitat. And so they were looking for places.
And Point Reyes now is a source of a lot of oysters.
Oh, yes, it is.
So what happened? What changed that allowed for oysters to suddenly thrive there?
Well, different technologies, actually. The oyster farmers have been able to be quite creative with how to make the oysters work in a habitat that isn't always the best for them. It depends, though. Oysters need a hard substrate, something to attach to, which we have a lot of here around New York, but not so much in the Bay Area. So the oysters are grown in bags or on strings and different methods that they use to grow some really wonderful oysters there.
Things kept on changing. The Great Depression had an impact. Mm-hmm. Then World War II had an impact.
Mm-hmm, that's right. It was fascinating to read about during World War II. At that time, most of the oysters they were getting were imported from Japan, and they were having less success in getting them to spawn in the area. They're better at it now. So the shipments were interrupted because of the war.
But at that time, weren't there also growing concerns about conservation?
With oysters or just in general?
Just conservation.
Oh, yes.
Along the coast especially.
Mm-hmm. Well, it hadn't... The suburban boom of the area hadn't really taken off yet. It was still very agricultural, even south of San Francisco. I read some wonderful accounts of older ranchers who knew that area at that time. And so there were concerns, beginning especially in the 30s, groups, the Marin Conservation League, they were concerned about advertising that you'd see as you drove out to the beach and all kinds of things like that. So efforts were already underway to try to preserve the area, and they really were galvanized after the Second World War when there was a huge influx of people coming who wanted to live there.
When did Charlie Johnson take over the Drake's Estero farm?
So he took over in the 50s. He was originally a wheat farmer from Oklahoma. He was working up in Oregon and then came down and started to farm with his family, his sons and his second wife, who he met actually when he was an oyster buyer for another company traveling to Japan.
So he had had experience with oysters, but mm-hmm. farming them?
Yes, I think he was more, he'd been more of a buyer, was my understanding, but his wife had some experience and they imported some techniques from Japan.
And they made a success of it.
They did pretty well for a while. Then they ran into some struggles. They had some environmental problems in later years.
What happened? What led to their conflict with the National Park Service?
Well, they were not so much in conflict with the National Park Service themselves, more with the county. They offered housing for their workers on site, but there were more people than than the septic system could handle. And so there was a sewage leaking into the bay. And they also had some problems with litter, pretty sizable problems of, you know, bits of plastic that you use in the operation escaping. And, you know, it's a national seashore, so they would get, they'd end up on the beaches throughout the area.
Who actually owned the land?
The land's owned by the federal government. Charlie Johnson had owned a few acres on land and then leased parts of the estuary to farm the oysters in. And then in 1972, he sold the few acres he had to the National Park Service for, and then got a 40-year lease that he signed at that time.
Could he and the other ranchers there have decided not to sell to the federal government, or did they have no choice?
Well, in a way, their hands were tied because of the inheritance taxes. So there was about a decade where people really weren't sure quite what was going to happen. There was a lot of pressure from developers in the area. They'd actually already sold parts of this land to developers, and they began building houses, much as you'd find in you know, South San Francisco.
If the government wanted to create a protected wilderness at Point Reyes, why did it then lease the land back to these ranchers?
Well, actually, all that happened before the designation of the wilderness. So there had been talk about putting a national research area or wilderness of some kind back from the very beginning of the park in the early 60s, mostly because they wanted to make sure that there were certain areas of the park that did not get changed. At that time, there was... they had considered maybe damming up an estuary and, you know, having paddle boats and a snack bar and a different kind of recreational place. And many biologists and people that love the area really wanted it to be preserved intact. But the wilderness area didn't actually get designated in Point Reyes until 1976. And by that time, most of the land had already been sold and then leased back to the agricultural community that had existed there.
My guest is Summer Brennan. She's written a book called The Oyster War, The True Story of a Small Farm, Big Politics, and the Future of Wilderness in America. What role did Congressman Philip Burton, one of the more colorful members of Congress, very important man in the fight against AIDS?
Yes.
But what was his role in this whole story?
So he ended up working on the Interiors Committee, and I think he was absolutely ruthless in working to protect wilderness areas and national parks all over the country. So this was, you know, part of his life's work doing this. And he is a colorful character. He was sort of the most unlikely wilderness advocate you could find. I'm trying to think of a story about Philip Burton that I can actually tell on the radio, and I'm not sure that there are a lot of them. But he, you know, somebody asked him if he wanted to go visit an area that he had helped to protect. And his response was basically to just take a drag on his cigarette, drop it, and say, you know, why the would I want to do that, and stamp it out. So,
was he one of the legislators behind the Point Reyes Wilderness Act of 1976? Yeah. It's interesting that the federal government would get involved in a local area.
Well, it was a national park at that time. So they had, you know, the park was established in 62.
But wasn't there a disagreement over what the word wilderness meant?
Absolutely. And that was actually one of the reasons why I was so drawn to this, is that was a question that came up again and again, what wilderness actually means.
Well, they also talked about potential wilderness.
Yes. So other than when a wilderness area is designated, especially during the Burton era, areas were designated as potential wilderness, and the idea was that there was some marring factor to the wilderness that wasn't allowed, such as a paved road or visible power lines or something like that. And so they would say, okay, well, it's potential wilderness, and we're going to work on removing that, and then we'll complete the wilderness designation. But no further deliberations are in order. It's just a question of kind of housekeeping.
Didn't Philip Burton use maps to help redraw protected land into Tamales Bay, for example? And some people said that was what he was doing was illegal.
Yeah. Well, there was a journalist I know who looked into this. That he was confused. Tamales Bay was included in this map of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, and when he went back through the files and finally, after much searching, found the original map, he saw that the cartographer had written a note saying these tidelands or these lands are to be shown included, you know, as per P. Burton's instructions, even though we will likely never acquire them.
Now, on the other hand, the Johnsons are not the ideal people to defend because they were leaking sewage.
I mean, I can't speak to them, you know, as a family. I visited the farm when it was Johnson Oyster Farm when I was a child, but no, the operation had a lot of problems. They also used spermicide on the shells of their oysters that they put in the estuary, which could probably cause problems. So it wasn't the most ecologically friendly business.
And then Kevin Lenny took over
mm-hmm.
the business?
Yes.
Was he an improvement?
He definitely tried very hard to be.
Mm-hmm. The park tried to get him to sign a document that stated that he knew his lease would expire in 2012.
Right. Yeah, this has become such a contentious issue locally because there's a lot of beliefs on other sides of it. But there is documentation. He was told that the lease is up in 2012. That decision was made before he even considered buying the farm. And he didn't want to sign that. He eventually did sign it, however.
Why did the National Park Service still consider the oyster farm as wilderness when it had been farmed for almost 100 years?
Well, it was not quite 100 years, just since, you know, the early 30s.
Okay, so 75
years.
Yeah,
so it tended to get a lot of exaggeration going on there, and I found that kind of amusing. So, yeah, 75, but in the 70s anyway. I think it speaks to an idea of wilderness as something that has to have never been trammeled versus something that is left to not be trammeled. And I think that's something that was at the core of this story, that a place it's still worth saving even if it has had our mark on it. We can remove that mark and it's still worthwhile. And I think that was, a very central issue that people fought about.
You were writing for the Point Reyes newspaper at the time?
Briefly, yes.
And that's how you got involved with the story, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Was there a lot of pressure being put on you and others in the area to take sides?
You have no idea. No, absolutely. I had no idea this conflict was going on. I mean, I visited my family who still lives out there, but I didn't know that this was happening until I got a job with this paper.
Why was it so contentious in the community?
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, I can't speak individually. People got involved for different reasons. Sometimes it's because, you know, their neighbor was involved and it was affecting them or would affect them personally or financially, and they wanted to support somebody that they trusted, or maybe it was symbolic, I think, in some ways.
And then some people thought that this was a blight on their community.
The farm? Or
the farms.
Yeah. I mean, the opinions about how the area should be used absolutely run the gamut. So you'll find everything in terms of, you know, there should be no national park whatsoever, to people thinking there should be no dairy farms or anything at all. So it's quite extreme on either end.
Was the oyster farms pollution really an environmental hazard, or is that something that perhaps the government exaggerated a bit?
Well, there is an issue about specific claims. But in terms of the hazard, the impression that I got is that if the national park was reasonable about setting boundaries within which the farm could operate and the farm was impeccable about following them, that environmentally it wasn't necessarily an incompatible situation. The question was about policy and precedence and what was decided in 76, not so much what the current farm was doing.
Hadn't you worked at the UN here in New York before you went out to Point Reyes?
Yes, and I still do.
You compare the negotiations in this matter to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
It really reminded me of it a lot, although I have to say that sometimes the Israeli-Palestinian discussions that I sit in on were a little more civil than this one. But yes, it was, you know, very much, well, this settlement and these lines. Yeah, there was a lot of similarities.
And then we have Dianne Feinstein getting involved and then Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar. Was everybody taking a position on this?
Yes, Dianne Feinstein supported the oyster farm. She wrote in its defense and put a rider on the bill to give Ken Salazar the option to extend the lease for another 10 years. And there was four different, you know, variations of that option, and he chose not to.
And then Kevin Lenny sued the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did.
Wasn't he trying to clean up the environmental hazard?
He was. I know that that's what they really wanted to do, and they had a lot of optimism there. I guess it just seemed to be just a disconnect because that wasn't really the issue. It was about policy and not, you know, they didn't want to weaken the Wilderness Act.
So what's the situation today? Are oysters being farmed on Point Reyes?
Well, they are being farmed in the area. I think recently Hog Island Oyster Company, which is very close by, won maybe the best oysters in the country or something like that. I don't hold me to that, but I just heard this from another oyster farmer. So there was some accolade given to them recently. But there's lots of wonderful oysters still being farmed. And actually, the last I heard is that Drake's Bay Oyster Company is opening a new farm. I don't know exactly where. Their communications person couldn't confirm that to me. But so they actually will go onwards, just not inside the national park.
Does this, we have very little time, but does this have implications for other areas where the whole matter of what is wilderness and what is not is in dispute?
I think it does, because that was what was at the center of it. And you had Dianne Feinstein writing, you know, this isn't a wilderness area because of such and such reason. It's proximity to urban areas or what have you. And so I think that there is, in a sense, a vulnerability to our ideas of wilderness, that it's a very interesting question, and I hope people can talk about it more.
Summer Brennan's book, The Oyster War, The True Story of a Small Farm, Big Politics, and the Future of Wilderness in America, is published in paperback by Counterpoint. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much, Leonard.